Hi, everybody. Welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer, and questioning communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight, our guest is Carl Dunn, zooming in from Berlin. Hello, Carl.
Hey, hey, how are you doing?
So nice to have you with us. Carl Dunn was the global advertising lead on several world-famous brands like Mini Cooper, Levi's, and Asics. He spent over two decades as a multi-award-winning advertising creative working in Australia, Asia, Africa, Europe, and America. His career culminated as a director of innovation for a powerhouse global advertising network.
Then it all burned to the ground when he told his husband he wanted a divorce. Just a few months later, Carl was sleeping on an air mattress in a former squat in Berlin with no job, visas, or money left. Using his divorce as his crisis of identity, Carl chronicled the whole experience in his book, How to Burn a Rainbow, where he gave up chasing everyone else's dream to find his own.
And we are really looking forward to speaking with you in more detail about your amazing book and your life. But first, here's news and events with Outbeat member and our engineer,
Greg Moralia.
This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of September 1st, 2024. This year, there will be at least 38 publicly out lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender athletes competing in the Paris Summer Paralympics. Over the last few weeks, Out Sports has enlisted the help of current and former Paralympians, fans, and journalists in determining who is publicly out at the Paris Games. The list is by no means exhaustive, and it will grow in the coming days and weeks. Out Sports reported that there were 36 out Paralympians in the Tokyo 2021 Games and a dozen in Rio in 2016. The increasing number over the last two games show how more and more athletes are coming out as LGBTQ+. An example of this new breed of para-athletes is Mar Gunnarsson. He's a swimmer from Iceland. He talked about being gay after the 2021 Tokyo Para Games and said, quote, "The news went viral here, and the amount of support I felt from the Icelandic nation was amazing," end quote. This year's Paralympics in Paris will run from August 28th until September 8th and will feature 4,400 athletes, including a record 1,983 women in 22 different sports and 549 medal events. And in Africa, most LGBTQ+ people already live in fear after being targeted with many draconian anti-gay laws. But the country of Ghana is now the latest to be hit with its own extreme bill. The Human Sexual Rights and Guyanian Family Values Bill of 2024 imposes prison sentences for anyone who identifies as LGBTQ+ and those who advocate, organize, or fund LGBTQ+ groups. Following the unanimous passage of the bill by the Guyanian Parliament back on February 28th, there's been a significant crackdown on LGBTQ+ communities in the country. Despite the imminent threat posed by this bill, Guyana's LGBTQ+ community has demonstrated remarkable resilience by moving forward with courage, innovation, and a deep commitment to survival in an otherwise hostile environment. The community has developed various strategies to navigate the perilous landscape, including the creation of digital safe spaces on platforms such as Twitter, Instagram, and WhatsApp. These platforms have become essential to Guyana's LGBTQ+ community and enable individuals to foster connection and to receive support. Underground art scenes have also emerged as powerful platforms for self-expression and resistance. These artistic spaces allow LGBTQ individuals to explore and express their identities in ways that are both personally fulfilling and politically subversive. This online activism has also brought international attention to the plight of Guyana's LGBTQ+ community, garnering solidarity and support from around the world. And here in the U.S., the hardware retailer Lowe's just announced that it is caving into pressure from far-right conservatives to remove LGBTQ+ inclusive programs from its company. Among other announcements, the company will no longer participate in the Human Rights Campaign surveys, and it will no longer be sponsoring pride parades. It will also combine all minority-related employee resource groups into one larger group to service every employee demographic. Lowe's is the third big corporation to drop its diversity initiatives after being targeted by online activists. Lowe's is still operating a webpage dedicated to advertising diversity on its website. It states, quote, "We're committed to fostering a culture where every member of the Lowe's team truly feels they belong. When associates can be their authentic selves at work, they perform at their best, and when that happens, we all win," end quote. The pressure on Lowe's apparently came from far-right influencer and anti-LGBT conspiracy theorist Robbie Starbuck, who has also led similar successful campaigns against Harley-Davidson, John Deere, and Jack Daniels. And in the state of Florida earlier this week, a federal appeals court overrode a landmark decision authorizing restrictions on gender-affirming care for minors and adults to go into law. In a 2-to-1 decision, judges in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals put a pause on an earlier trial court decision that banned Governor Ron DeSantis' law that denied access to gender-affirming care. This decision means that minors can no longer access any medical gender-affirming care in the state, including hormone replacement therapy and surgery. Additionally, there are multiple restrictions for adults, including mandating that consent forms be signed in person, thus creating a barrier for anyone who relies on telehealth appointments, and mandating that only physicians can apply such care, depriving people of access to many medical providers. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia.
And if you just joined us, we are talking with Carl Dunn, author of How to Burn a Rainbow. Again, Carl, we want to thank you for giving us a little time from your very busy schedule.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
So tell us, how did you come up with the title of your book? And give us the whole title.
Sure thing. Well, so this book used to be called, and for a very long time was called, My Gay Divorce, which I hated. I mean, I didn't love it as a title. I didn't have anything else. And I had been trying to find a new title for it without much success. And I had a great subtitle, which was My Gay Marriage Didn't Make Me Whole, My Divorce Did. And I liked that. And I thought maybe that was going to be the title. I couldn't figure it out. And then one day I was having a conversation with at a party with a straight guy here who was about to start his own divorce. And we were talking a lot about the book. And he's like, man, your book sounds really interesting. And we're having this whole conversation about chasing rainbows and, you know, following the scripts that everybody gives us. And I said, yeah, it's like, it's kind of like, I said, you know, sometimes I think about maybe it should be like How to Burn a Rainbow Flag, but that doesn't sound right either. It sounds like it could be anti. And then he just goes, How to Burn a Rainbow. It's cooler. I see myself in it. I'm like, oh, that's fantastic. So that's how the title came about. And it really stuck. It's one of those titles that, in fact, I was very fortunate. I got to meet Elizabeth Gilbert, and what an amazing human being she is. And I was telling her about my book, and I just happened to have a copy with me to give her, just happened to have. And when I handed it to her, she was like, oh, that's such a good title. She's like, that's really good. She's like, I hear a lot of book titles, but that's a good one. It sticks. So, yeah, people seem to really like it. And then the cover of the book, which is a burning wedding cake, was, you know, originally I had an actual rainbow that was on fire. But again, that looked kind of anti, you know, like I thought it looked cool, but people are like, dude, you can't. I'm like, yeah, you're probably right. And so I think what was nice about that is, you know, when you give up being right about what you think it should be. Someone said, well, I've never seen like a wedding cake on fire. I'm like, oh, that's cool. So, yeah, so that's how it became How to Burn a Rainbow. My Gay Divorce Didn't Make Me Whole. My Divorce Did. And why that. It has that cover of two guys standing on top of a burning wedding cake. Yeah.
So My Gay Marriage Didn't Make Me Whole, My Divorce Did. Mm. That is very deep.
Mm.
I think it's very deep. You know, when we're kids, we're led to believe that when you find the one and you get married, you're two halves and you make a whole. And your subtitle just kind of puts that into the wind.
Yeah.
And Why don't you tell us a little bit about the book?
Sure. I mean, the book really delves into my divorce. So like when it happened, I basically dated the same guy like 5-6 times in a row, and then I just married the last one, but it was the same relationship every time. The dynamics were the same. It ended the same way. And so clearly I had been seeking out this particular type every time. And when my divorce started, I thought, you know, I've got to get to the bottom of this. I got to figure out why I'm doing this to myself. Why am I constantly picking this same dynamic to put myself into? And I think a lot of it, the divorce is definitely what kicked it off. And what people have found most people have found kind of interesting is like, it's a book about gay divorce. So it's a very fresh take on divorce. A lot of heterosexuals who've read it have really enjoyed it because you don't come down on either side of the battle of the sexes. Like, you'd have no skin in that game at all. Like, our relationships are very gendered, but in a very different way. So while it's the instigator of the story, the inciting incident, and also what propels a lot of it, it's the bigger story is about a human being who went on a journey to find themselves. And that's what it was about. You know, for me, I think I'd expected every person I've ever dated, and then my ex-husband, to wave some magic wand and make all the dark things about myself that I don't like disappear. And I don't think any of us ever tell someone else, that's your job, by the way, as my partner. Like, I'm just going to put you on that because I haven't done it myself, but I'd like you to do it. It's really hard. It's so hard. I haven't done it. So I'll outsource that. And, you know, I think it, you know, when that didn't happen and when, you know, the whole idea of marriage didn't do all the things I thought it was going to do. Like, I woke up married in this beautiful house with this amazing job, all this money that I was making every month, big group of friends, great life in LA. And I'm like, I'm not happy and I should be happy. And I don't know why. And I could not figure it out. Cause like, I did everything everyone said. Why doesn't it feel the way it's supposed to feel? So all these things had not done the jobs that I had wanted them to do. And instead, what I had seen amongst my straight male friends, when their wives or girlfriends get pregnant for the first time, the men I know anyway, go freak out. Oh my God, I'm an overgrown boy. And in 9 months, I have to be a role model to a human being. Like, I've got to figure myself out. And, you know, you don't do it in 9 months, but the guys I would go on this, like, who am I? What do I stand for? What are my values? You know, what do I want to pass on? And I thought, okay, well, I'm probably never going to have kids. I mean, I don't think it's really on the cards for me, but I thought I could use my divorce as this crisis of identity that I'd seen my friends go through. And so that's what I did. I decided to hang on to this thing and not run from all the hard parts of it and all the really hard emotions and just sit with them all and get to know them. Yeah. So that's what it became. That's really the whole, that in a nutshell is basically the entire story. Now, it runs from Los Angeles to Berlin. It goes from me living this high-flying advertising life to sleeping in a former squat in Berlin. It goes through, you know, getting divorced from my ex-husband, the rebound that I had. A lot of people say it reads almost like a thriller in a funny way. Like, people who've read it are like, I can't believe all this actually happened to you. It's like, yep, in 18 months. But essentially, the story is really just about a human trying to figure themselves out. It's really it.
That leads me to ask this question. What you went through can happen in the straight world, right? With lawyers who are inept and trials that get postponed and partners who try to screw you over. I mean, how is this different? How is your journey different than somebody who's straight getting a divorce?
Well, I think we go through different kinds of loss that heterosexuals don't. Obviously, we share the thing of okay, our marriage is coming to an end. This relationship is coming to an end. And human beings everywhere, I think that feels the same. But for me, there was a loss of these feelings of equality that had been conferred upon me by having a ring on my finger. And it is incredible how much society rewards, recognize the kudos of having a ring on your finger is. It's an absolute. My husband, nobody can touch that. You know, my partner, my boyfriend, it's like, oh yeah, you know, but your husband, everybody gets what that is. And, you know, I hate to say it's something I talk about in the book, but the day I got engaged, which was when I had the ring on and the first day back at work, and the kudos, the congratulations, the brotherhood that I had with all these straight married guys who, after the word went around, 10 minutes later, they're all in my office, back slaps, champagne. It was wild. And I couldn't believe how much what I was doing meant to them. But for them, I was just a guy getting married. And it was funny. It was the first time in my life I ever felt like I was as good as they were, which is again, terrible because I'm relying on a ring to do it. And, you know, and it's not the kind of thing we all say to each other in the fight, but it was true. I mean, I finally felt like I was as good as they were. And I loved that, but I also hated how much I loved it. But now that was gone. And now it's just back to being just some random gay guy getting a divorce, you know, like I felt like I dropped rungs. So I think we go through that kind of a loss, the loss of the equality that we had. And for me also, there was definitely a feeling of letting down the side, like really letting down the cause because we'd fought so hard for it. And we were fairly early-ish in the marriage, you know, getting married after it was passed again. And then within 2 years, we were getting divorced. And it was made clear to me by several never married members of the, you know, gay male community in Los Angeles that I had definitely let the side down. So it was quite strange to feel this weird, like you become a pariah in your own community. In the straight world, that would have garnered sympathy. In our world, it was like I was now a bit of an outcast. And that was tough. Yeah. And then just feeling like you kind of wrecked it for everyone, I think. So we go through different types of loss. And then when you get into a divorce, you suddenly discover that divorce law is written for the battle of the sexes. And if you're the one who earns more, oh, the losses you will go through when you're like, I don't understand this. We're the same gender. There's no children. I don't get this. Why am I broke and sleeping on an air mattress? Like, I don't get this. And then the other kind of loss that we go through is we've lost the ability to negotiate the end of our relationships as LGBTQ plus people because we couldn't get married for so long. We had the chance to negotiate with each other at the end of a relationship and figure out how we wanted to do that together. And that is completely gone because when you get married, now the government owns your relationship because you signed a marriage contract. And when you want out, you have to do it by their rules. And then you encounter divorce law, which is completely written for the battle of the sexes. So if you are the one who earns more, which is what I was, which, you know, divorce law is set up for the battle of the sexes as they were at the end of the, at sort of end of the 80s, start of the 90s. And it's designed with a model in mind of there's a man working who's earning, there's a woman who might be working but isn't earning as much and has the kids, but she's probably at home raising the kids. And there is a massive presumption within divorce law that this is the model, it's serving. So when you have two people, same gender, no children, you're like, what is this? And I had lost complete control of the end of my relationship. Like I had no say in it. So yeah, there were a lot of losses, I think, that were very different for us as LGBTQ plus people.
And it's interesting that you looked for books and and information and couldn't find any.
No. It's funny, even now if you Google like LGBTQ plus divorce, gay divorce, same-sex divorce, there's hardly anything, even now. It's a bit of a desert, actually. And a few people said to me, I think your book's a bit ahead of the curve, which means I will make my millions later? I don't know.
Yeah, so that brings me back to the beginning of how you, I mean, you said a lot of things in your book about your life. I mean, what prompted you to even have the courage to like put your life on those pages? Be for education, for other people to understand, or, I mean, I'm just curious.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's honestly, it's the reason why I didn't publish it for so long. I sat on it for about a year or so because I had a lot of fear about putting something so personal out there. Even friends of mine who read it earlier versions were like, dude, are you sure you want all this in the world? But I think if you're going to write a book like this, you have to be completely 100% honest in it, and you have to share all the things that you went through for it to ring true and be helpful for other people. And also, I got a lot of courage from Augustine Burroughs, who wrote Dry and Running with Scissors. And those books are, I mean, you read those books, the agonizing detail of his alcoholism and the things that he did. And he would bring you to the brink of despair and then flip it and make you laugh. I mean, it was incredible. But I went to a writer's thing once that he was speaking at, and I asked him about that because I said, look, we think we know personalities and celebrities because we see their photographs. We don't really know them, but you, we know every agonizing detail of your life. How do you buy groceries? Like, how do you just walk through the world now? And he said, I thought it was really interesting. He said, when you've given that much and you've hidden nothing, people respect it. And he said, nobody has ever used anything in the book that I've ever said about me. No one's ever used that against me, ever. Because if they get what you did and you hid nothing. So I thought, all right, I'm just going to hang on to that and off we go. Yeah.
And how has it been?
Remarkable. Remarkable. Here's an interesting thing about publishing a book is right up until the moment you publish it, it's your book. The moment you've published it, you don't own this book anymore. It's not yours. It now belongs to everybody who reads it. And what's interesting is I have my relationship with the book, but everybody else who reads it has their relationship with it. And what I've found interesting is that people not in our community who haven't gone through divorce have read the book and they found themselves in the pages. And they say, yeah, when I read this part, this really touched me because it gave me peace with this. I mean, some of the things people have told me about that it's given them peace about a child who passed early from different circumstances, from, you know, heterosexual friends of mine have said, I finally understand, like, I thought I understood what it was like to grow up as someone gay. But now that I read your book, I'm like, wow, it's like, I really get it. Like all the things you write, I've heard them all before, but when it's all connected, they said, I have so much more respect for my gay friends and what they've been through and actually who they are, the parts about them I don't see. Even like straight people have said to me, I read your book out of interest, but when I got to the end of it, I knew myself better. I knew my wife better. There's a guy who was telling me this. And he said, and I understood our relationship and our marriage in a way that I never have before. And I never expected that to get that from a book that a gay guy wrote about his divorce. So it's doing all kinds of things out there. Yeah, it's really interesting. And I get a lot of kudos from straight divorce guys who are like, thank you for writing about what we go through. Because when we say it, no one listens. But when a gay guy says it, he went through it, people are like, oh man, that's rough. That's terrible. It's funny. It's like people have empathy for it. Even like a woman said, you know, until I read your book, like now that I finished it, I have a lot more empathy for what my ex-husband went through. Couldn't hear it from him. But from you, yeah, all right, I'll listen. So I don't know, it's doing all kinds of, so this is what I mean, like once it's out, it's everybody else's book and it's great. So as the author, as you travel around and talk to people, you find out more about what your own book means. Isn't that crazy? I love that. I just love it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
What surprised you?
I think the universality of it. I hoped it would be. But the questions that I would get asked at like book readings or random people, it's all the same stuff. Yeah, it was really interesting that the questions that people would ask about respect, about loss, about regrets, about why do breakups hurt so much. And it's really interesting, like sometimes we would get into it in these rooms and they became these really interesting, intimate spaces where it's a real cross-section of people there, but it's all the same stuff, you know? And I love that my book had some small part in doing that dynamic, because I think that's really powerful when a lot of people who seemingly have nothing in common will sit down and talk about really intimate stuff. And then it's like, actually, we're all talking about the same thing. It's quite kind of beautiful. So, yeah, I'd say that was the thing that surprised me the most. Yeah.
Your book reminds me of the hero's journey.
Mm.
You know, it's like, yeah, you're down on your luck, on your back, and you just keep climbing to that place of finding who you are.
Mm.
And I love that. The journey. That's what it was about. The journey.
Yeah.
Definitely. Can you say something about that journey?
Well, first of all, when you commit to a journey, so anyone who's listening, if you're in some situation and you want to get out of that situation, but you can see you don't know what lies ahead if you jump, just jump. It's a bit like driving at night. Like, you got the headlights on, you can't see the road, but you know it's going to be there. You'll see the road. Bigger than that, though, when you commit to this, you know, however you like to think of God, or the universe or whatever, the greater power, because I believe there is a greater power, however anyone thinks about it, will send mighty forces to your aid, and they will come in the form of guides. And there will be people who will pop up at exactly the right time with exactly the right information and wisdom for you at that moment. And you just kind of develop this. Your job is to step through the looking glass and receive it. Be aware that it's coming and just note when it comes and receive it. And these people can be like, you might have known them for decades, right? And they just drop something on you that's nothing like anything they've ever said. Or it could be someone who just like pops up on a bus for a chat. I mean, one of the most profound stories in there, I think, is from the guy who cut my hair. I'd never been to him before. I was just back in the States and he cut my hair and I was off again. But he dropped some crazy wisdom on me that was wild, you know? So I think that's the other thing is like when you jump, you will be met with everything you need on the way. And you will have moments where you go like, I can't handle this. I want to go back. But you're so far away from shore, you can't see the land anymore. And you can't see the land of where you're going, but you're like, well, I mean, I guess I got to keep going. Because honestly, it's go back to what? That thing I hated so much that I left. Got to keep going. So you just got to keep going when you're on these things. It's really important. Just continue, you know?
Yeah, being really open.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Eyes wide open.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like that's what you did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was helpful losing everything. That helped a lot. Yeah. Lose your job,
can
lose
you
all your money.
Can you imagine yourself saying that?
Yeah, I mean, lose everything. Yeah. You have nothing else to do but focus on the road ahead. So I'm not recommending, like, don't wait till you have, like, till you crash and burn like I did. You don't have to do that. You can be a little more comfortable than I was. But for me, that's what I needed, apparently, to get through this. Because I think it's the disservice of, you know, working in an industry where you earn an insane amount of money is you can always distract yourself. Super easy to do, you know. Scroll through Instagram. What don't I have? Right, I'm getting that, you know. And the short-lived serotonin high. But I would say the other thing about going on a journey is there is no greater feeling than knowing yourself. It is the greatest feeling. It beats out anything you can buy. Anything you can own, anything you can, you know, anything that's on Instagram. Any food, any drink, that's all fun. But to truly know yourself, I think is the most radical thing that a human being can do. It's the simplest and at the same time, the hardest thing to do. But it's amazing. And I think like another thing I'd say about journeys is that often when you're going through hardship, people say, this will all be worth it one day. And I disagree completely because I think every day where you're going through it and you learn just that little bit more about how you feel about anger or your relationship to regret or how loss can feel okay. Every time you learn a little bit more about that and how you roll with that, it is the greatest feeling. It is like today I know myself a bit better, and it's actually quite addictive when you're on it. It's a bit like going through like boot camp or something, but it's worth it every single day you're on it. And then one day it sort of all culminates into a, you know, this kind of greater sense. So yeah, big fan of journeys.
I just want to go back to one thing you said. Is there any way you'd be willing to share the words of wisdom from your hairdresser?
It was amazing. He was telling me in a nutshell, he and his ex-girlfriend were the, you know, homecoming king and queen. He was playing in a rock band. It was getting some traction. She's the cheerleader. He's out on the road a lot. She does not like this. He said they fight constantly when he's on the road. They fight constantly when he's at home. And it's her concerns about all these women that she's seeing on the socials coming to his concert, leather clad, tattooed, you know, and she's like the nice American girl. And he's like, and he was saying, I'm not even into like those women who come to our gigs. Like they're cool, but I'm not, that's not my vibe. Right. So anyway, it gets to a point where the band's taking off and the relationship is in jeopardy. So he leaves the band and he learns to cut hair. And they're staying at home. Things are better. Then one day she gets Portland in her head. Portland. Got to move to Portland. So he's like, okay, fine. I can cut anywhere. Like, I don't know why Portland, but let's go. She's a graphic designer. She gets a job there. And he said, then she falls in with a group of women, starts coming home later and later, drunker and drunker, gets her first tattoo. And he's like, I'm not mad, but what's going on? She slowly over time became the women that she used to complain about or was worried about at the gigs. And so they split up and he moved back to LA. And this, what he said, which was amazing, he said, we were both pretending to be something we weren't to keep the other one. She was pretending to be this all-American girl, good girl, to keep this guy who's now pretending to be a hairdresser, who's actually a guitarist in a rock band. So we're both pretending. And he said, every time you don't do something because of the person you're with, you're lying to them. And when he said that to me, I'm like, well, I was lying to my husband for years, apparently, because there were a lot of things I wanted to do. There were many things I wanted to be, and I wasn't doing them because I was with this person. And that's not his fault. That was something I chose. So yeah, when he dropped that one on me, I was like, wow, here's a big tip.
He gave you a tip and you gave him a tip.
Certainly did. Yeah.
So, Carl, you talked about, I'm loving this interview, by the way. You're wonderful.
Oh, thank you. So, thank you. Me too. I'm enjoying myself.
Yeah. You talked about the journey, but I want to talk about what you shared in your book about the part about the chorus. You know, and everybody has a different name for the chorus, the voice, right? But it's really important, I think, to share that part because you talk about leaving everybody else's ideas and living the dream of everybody else's, but finding your own self. And I think that'll be an important piece to talk about. How did that you learning about the chorus in your voice and your voice become you, change you?
It was something I had to tune into. What I realized, like when you go through crises after crises after crises, which is what my divorce was, there's a lot of violent emotions. There's a lot of panic. There's a thousand ideas of what to do and how to get around it. But what I started to notice was there was one I started calling the voice and the chorus. The voice would always speak first and would say the thing that actually made the most sense. I believe the voice when it speaks is my instinct, my true instinct. And then it's like, and 3, 2, 1, and here comes the chorus. And the chorus is a thousand voices with the worst ideas that maybe might feel better to do right now. They're not going to work out better for you. And typically what I would do is ignore the voice, listen to the chorus from this bucket of hastily thrown together ideas, just reach in and fish out one of them and go, this is what we're doing, you know, and I would run and do that. And it would be a disaster. And the chorus will convince you you've done the right thing until you're drowning in quicksand. And then the voice will go, kind of tried to tell you. So the voice became about listening to my true instinct. And something else, a practice I picked up that I write about in How to Burn a Rainbow is the emotions diary. And this was very pivotal to help me really start to understand how I was wired. And again, I don't claim to know how this works. Like there's the voice and the chorus, and then there would be a voice that spoke from the emotions diary, and it was his own separate entity. I don't really know exactly what it was, I don't know. And actually, I think it's really nice to not know sometimes how things work. Like we do need more mysteries in this life. But I would start and do this thing. I kept a journal, and the journal would be, I started this format of what, ask, and wait. And so I would write down what had happened that day. This happened and that really annoyed me. And then this person at work, and like I'd be writing. And then suddenly it would crystallize into a question. And it would be like, why can't I get a break? Why can't my ex-husband stop doing X or like whatever it was? Why am I feeling this about this person? And then you wait, and I can't explain how an answer comes, and then you just write the answer down. And it would take very different tones, sometimes very comforting, like a friend, other times like a coach, like hard ass coach. That's just like, seriously, we're here again. We're doing this one again. How many times do I have to tell you? Like that kind of impatience almost, like with a slap. But everything it told me was 100% true. It was wild. And the thing is, I would read what I'd written and think, I didn't know that. Or I didn't think I knew that. Maybe it was locked in here somewhere. So I don't know what it is, like whether it's your grandma's ghost or the universe or God, however we think about God or a spirit God. I don't know what it is, but it does work. And the emotions diary also really helped me tune in. Between the emotions diary and the voice, I really started to tune in on the wisdom. I think it's a funny thing, I think we spend our whole lives looking externally for answers when what I was starting to find is, wait, do I have every answer already? And I'm just not looking inside, which is not to say that you know everything, but again, I guess it's about knowing yourself and what your moral compass is and what the dent you want to make in the universe, the way you want to roll as a human being. So yeah, it was. I would say that's kind of the voice in the chorus is all of that, all of that.
That's very powerful. As a psychotherapist, I mean, I work with so many clients, and that's the issue. That's the core, and I wanted to pull that out of you to share that because that's really important. Those different voices that trip us up all the time, but you labeled it the wisdom that we have that wisdom within ourselves. We just have to stop.
Yes.
It's beautiful. Thank you for the way you explained that.
Ah, you're very welcome. You're welcome. I mean, I did it so much. Although sometimes it's good to go back and actually just do it physically in the book, but I did it so much that now I find I don't need to write it to have it activate, because it was something I did nonstop for like 2 years. That now I find if I just sit with it, I can formulate a question and then ask the question and then the answer comes and I hear it. But it's always good to go back to the basics sometimes. And sometimes I'll just pull the emotions diary out. So let's do it old school. Let's write it out again. And somehow that does refresh the connection, I think.
I particularly like your second step where you wait. You really respect the process. You don't need to get the answer right away. Like, I'm going to write the question. Here's the answer. You build into your paradigm a breathing space of just to listen before the answers come. You're giving yourself that time because everybody wants the answer so quickly. And even though you have it inside you and you're tapping into your inner wisdom, you're giving yourself this lush period to just wait.
Yeah.
I think that's very powerful, like Diana was saying.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's a rare thing, I think, to give ourselves the time to just wait and receive. I think so much of our world is on demand. And, phones have made us, I mean, I include myself in this, just so spectacularly impatient that it is nice to tap into something that doesn't seem to involve any technology at all and to just wait a moment and there it comes. And I do wonder sometimes if we, you know, with all the technology we have, I mean, we were talking at the beginning, the listeners won't know, but, you know, technology, Zoom, passwords, wah, you know, I think somehow in all of that, maybe we're just losing the divine connection that we all have. I mean, I didn't think I was this connected to whatever it is that is the greater force. I didn't think I was as connected to it as I am. But again, this is what it took. I mean, when I say that, you know, my divorce was the greatest thing that ever happened to me, it really was. I mean, on so many different levels. Interesting.
So looking into future relationships, are you single?
No.
Need to know about that. Okay.
Well, yeah, it's really interesting how this entire process has changed the way I love. So this whole thing that I went through, and then even once the divorce was over, the years after where I was still single, it was just this process of not just getting right with myself, but letting that cement dry. And to the point where the loneliness in my life had gone away. I didn't feel lonely. I was a kind of master of my aloneness, if you like, where it became, if someone comes along, great. If they don't, also great. And I was starting to develop a life that was just about me and what I would do, you know, as a single person. And it was looking really good. And then up popped Derek. And my partner has his own like journey that he's gone on to arrive at in his own way. And he's arrived at the same place. So it's interesting when you meet someone who has gone through the same thing as you and you don't need each other, but you want to be with each other. And it's a very different way to start a relationship. We didn't rush. You know, I actually said to him at one stage, there is no one else. I'm not seeing anyone else. You're not in competition with anyone. But I do not feel any, I don't want to rush this or give it a name or anything. I would just like to do more of it. And he's like, that sounds great. And I think what's also kind of interesting at this, you know, when you're not looking for someone to complete you, when you're not looking for someone to fix you, the list, and I used to have some pretty long lists of what someone had to be. I mean, my list now is good heart, good smile. Are they passionate about something in their life? Doesn't have to be, I don't have to like it. I don't have to be interested in it at all. But if they are passionate about something, they have that in their life, and that they are at peace with their relationship with their family, whether they talk to them every day or they're never talking to them ever again, that they are at peace with that, because if that is not resolved, you're getting that. That dynamic is now going to come and visit you. And I mean, it's a kind of short list, but it's only four things on it, but I think those four things are kind of deep. They require character, you know, for someone to have gone through some things. So, and now that we're together, I mean, honestly, it is the easiest thing in the world to be with this guy. We have never fought once about anything. People find this very strange, but we do not fight. If we don't, it's our relationship's very clear. We understand what it is. Neither of us believe we can be the be-all and end-all of everything for the other one. So we have our life together, and we also have our own lives. We don't live together. And this suits us perfectly right now. Maybe it will change. Maybe we will move in together. But there's no doubt in my mind that I'm like fully committed to this man as my partner. And the same in return. So it's, I don't know, it's like, I didn't know it could be this easy. I thought you were meant to fight with your partner if you loved them. But turns out not. So
I guess living in separate homes helps.
I mean, This is the other thing as well. When you meet as fully formed adults, you know, in your 40s, it's like there are times when I just need to have no one in my house. No one, you know, and it does help, you know, because we do both like our alone time. He's an artist and he loves to work at night. He can work all night. So, you know, also for our work, it fits that we both have time to just be on our own and do our thing. I mean, I'm enjoying a lull at the moment, but, you know, I'm starting on my next book. I'm starting on my next stuff, just starting to gear up to that. But honestly, after 6 months of putting a book together, oh, the learning curve I went through, eesh, self-publishing. And then the book tour of 2 months. I mean, the amount of new things I had to learn, I had no idea. Like, I have so much more, not that I didn't before, but I have so much more respect for touring performers of any kind. I wasn't playing stadiums. I didn't have hundreds of thousands of fans to satisfy. I just had like bookstore appearances and things. And honestly, you're working 6, 8, 10 hours a day, making content, pushing the book out, getting the messages out there, up on LinkedIn. I mean, it's a never-ending thing. It was exhausting. So it's nice to just have a little lull and then the next stage will begin. Yeah. But that's how I am now with Eric. I mean, this process changed how I love. So I'm grateful for it.
Wonderful. So you gave us a little sneak on preview of the new book. What are you working on? I'm curious now. Is it something to do with this, with divorce, or is it a whole different thing?
No, it's not. Weirdly, yes, but no. Okay, so I mentioned before that, you know, heterosexual guys were really happy about the fact that I'd written about them. But in particular, I write about something I discovered at my office, which is there's a straight guys divorce club. And if you want to find this club anywhere where you're working, if you're working in any kind of office building, just go to the concrete bench outside where people can smoke, and that's where you'll find them. And it was a really interesting dynamic that was created between all these men who were all going through divorces or have been through divorces. And what was interesting about it was people from the mailroom to the C-suite. It was like four different religions, all kinds of political stripes. Some people were born in the States. Other people, like myself, were immigrants. Different sexualities, obviously. I was the, you know, I could introduce that to the group. Oh, that's something new. But yeah, what was interesting about it was we all needed each other. We were all survivors of the same shipwreck, all facing the same problems, and we're all on the same life raft together. And it was the most fascinating microcosm of true DEI, because everybody's opinion had the same weight. Inside that building, there was a hierarchy that we were all beholden to, but outside at the bench, we were all equal. And it was a really fascinating group of people to belong to, because I mentioned before the equality I felt when I had a ring on my finger was nothing compared to the brotherhood I had with those guys. Because once you realize that there is this invisible group of people around you, it's almost a bit like being at Fight Club. You would find straight divorce guys everywhere. And the minute they know you're going through one, they literally will drop what they're doing and they're like, dude, let's talk. How's yours going? I've never been in AA. I don't know what that's like, but I imagine there's probably similarities, you know, because I think divorce is the great equalizer. And I think alcoholism and recovery operates the same way. It doesn't care what you were doing before you got to that room. So yeah, it was fascinating. And there's a couple of stories in particular that came out of that were very interesting. And a lot of it is to do with the fact that we had an artificial thing happen that forced us to listen to each other, to be in conversation with people who were totally outside our normal worlds, and to really listen to one another because we needed each other. And that was, I think, something that's missing today. I am anti-cancel culture. I am anti big time. I do not think it helps anyone. I think the moment we are not in conversation with the people that we are up against for whatever reason, it only gets worse. And I think we can always find common ground with people, even if it isn't about the thing that we are divided over. There are things we have in common, and we can find those. And when we find those, and we stay in conversation, it forces both of us to see the other person's humanity, because we both think we're right, you know? So it was interesting. Even in the divorce club, there were guys who were, some pretty conservative religious guys. There were some pretty arch political persuasions that did not allow for LGBTQ plus people to even exist. But we had a connection, and we had a value to each other without it being that. And I think that was really interesting, because here's what I think happens after that. The next time they're in a room where no one from the LGBTQ plus community will be in, and someone says, those queers, like whatever, there will be someone in that room who goes, well, actually, I know this guy at work and he's all right. And here's someone else speaking on our behalf, who's become a very unlikely ally speaking on our behalf, because he does recognize my humanity. Therefore, other people like Carl must also have this humanity. And I think that's, so I'm super against canceling people. I think we all need each other, and whether we like it or not, we all need each other. And yeah, we got to figure this out, and we're only going to figure it out together. So yeah. So that's kind of what I'm talking about next. And this book, I don't have a title for it yet, but it is about connecting people in an ever more divided world and how we do that. So that's what I'm working on now. And it's really nice, because it's bringing together a lot of my life. Like, I've lived and worked all over the world. I've spent most of my life outside the country of my nationality. I've been a foreigner living on the good graces of governments all over the place. I've been the visible minority in many places. And I think also, like, your listeners won't notice from hearing my voice, but as a white male who looks like the world was built for him and gets a lot of stuff for free walking through the world, just based on what people see of me and what they perceive. A lot of things I get for free. Some I know, some I don't even know. But then you go somewhere where you are the racial minority as a white person is so educational, because you're like, this is what everyone talks about. Got it. People sometimes don't even mean to be mean. I think my perspective of having lived and worked all over the world and seen the good and the bad of all the different ways that societies go. I've lived in countries where I've had full rights. I've lived in countries where I'm completely illegal, and it's given me a perspective on the world, because I really think we have just so much more in common than most of us realize, but we don't get to that if we don't talk to one another. And nothing beats two human beings talking. You can't fake it. You can't Google it. You can't Zoom it. You can't buy it. People have to experience it themselves. They have to have the aha moment with someone else themselves, and then it lands. So yeah, that's what I'm working on next. I want to help make what happened to me in that divorce club, I want to help make that happen for more people in corporations, in societies, in, I don't know. But again, this is the next journey. I have literally no idea how I'm going to do this, but I know this is what I'm meant to do next. And the road will appear. The guides will pop up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The way you spoke about it, Carl, I mean, I could feel the passion. So hopefully it'll be an easy write for you. And you had a nice title in there too. So when you listen back to this recording, take a look at what you said. I think that was a beautiful title that came out of your description.
Oh, what did you, what was it? What was the one?
Diana can hear.
Something about connecting. I know connecting was right in there. It was beautiful.
Because as you know, I don't write the titles of any of my books. I rely completely on other people to do that.
So when you come, across that connecting word, that was it. That was like, wow, right. I could see that as a title,
Excellent.
So, wow, this has been great. And there's so much more we want to know about you.
Yeah, it is time to say goodbye to you. But before we do that, do you have any words of wisdom that you can impart on our listeners? Besides, get my book.
Can you speak to a young adult who's low self-esteem about being gay? What advice or what support could you offer to them?
Well, the first thing I'd say is there's absolutely nothing wrong with you at all. I think one of the problems we have as a minority group is that we are not born to our own kind. And I think if you come from any other kind of minority group, if you're African-American, you're born in a black house with black brothers and sisters, black parents, black music, black culture, black leaders, black thought, grandparents, a history. And I think, most minorities can have that. We don't have that. We're straight people have queer kids. And I think that because of that, and they don't know that we're a naturally occurring phenomena, and that literally we're not against nature. Epigenetics proves that we are 100% a part of nature, an essential part of nature. But often our families don't know what to do with us because we seem so different to them. But you're not different. And you do have family out there in the world. And if you're young and you haven't met them yet, you haven't met your chosen family yet, know that queer people are everywhere. You have siblings and uncles and aunts and grandparents, and there'll be younger ones coming up that you have to lift up. And you know that you're not an accident. You're not a mistake. You are meant to be here. And so, do not be ashamed of yourself. Be yourself. Find yourself. And if that's not possible where you are, then get somewhere where it is. And it does get better. It really does. And to quote Dan Savage, it really does get better. And I remember being you. I remember being a very confused young gay man in the 80s, when we're in the middle of the AIDS epidemic, where coming out as gay was a political act. Coming out as gay, most people thought you're going to be lonely for the rest of your life. And, I know a lot of LGBTQ plus people are isolated, but trust me, it is better now than it has ever been. You can connect and find these people online. You're not alone. It can feel that way sometimes, but you are not alone, and you will be fabulous. You will be incredible. It's coming. It is coming. Just be a little patient. Find your people, find your place, and off you go. Yeah.
Thank you for that. Beautiful.
We want to thank you so much for being on our show with us, Carl. It's time to say goodbye. But remember, just like Carl, you too can be living proof that through being visible and vibrant, sometimes vulnerable and perseverant, and finding your niche, you too can make this world a better world. This is Diana and Sheridan, and we will be back next month. Until then,
good night.
I step out of the ordinary. I can feel my soul ascending. I'm on my way. Can't stop me now. And you can.
Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCB-FM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB-FM Roanoke Park and KRCG-FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. The Jazz Hot is next.